We left off with two sort of unanswered questions. If you recall what they were, one was a sort of a side question related to Rosh Chodesh. I made the suggestion that there was the original plan between David and Yonatan was that they would hide for the day of Rosh Chodesh, and one day Rosh Chodesh became 2 days Rosh Chodesh, and why that was significant, I said we would come back to. It's really a side point of the story. Nonetheless, it's there. But the much bigger question...
Why does David cry now?
Right. That's the much bigger question. And for that, we need to go back to the end of Perek Mem... end of Perek Chaf. Chazuk Mem Aleph. And Narba, if David come me'etzel ha-Negev, the lad had gone by, right? We talked about the relationship between the Na'ar and his role in the story. But in the meantime, David and Yonatan had a chance to meet. David came out of his hiding. He fell. He prostrated himself to the ground, bowed down. Vayishku ish et re'eyu. They embraced. They kissed. Vayivku ish et re'eyu. They cried one for the other. Ad David higdil. Until David exceeded. More or less, David cried more. In a pasuk that is remarkably balanced, Vayishku ishet ve'eyu, they embraced one the other. Vayivku ishet ve'eyu, they cried for each other. In a pasuk that's remarkably balanced, to add Ad David Igdil can't be an accident. It's not just an arbitrary, oh, David cried more. There's got to be something there that's of significance. Why is the Navi telling me that David cried more? So, there's a simple approach would be to say what? Simple approach would be
that's more dramatic for David.
Because?
He didn't know where
because he's the one who has to run, right? Yonatan is going to go back to the city,
right.
And David is going to be left to run for his life. This is really the flight of his life, because from here, he's never going to return. This is going to be one way. He's going to reach very, very quickly, going to reach rock bottom. He has nowhere to go. He has no food. He has no weapon. He has no defense. He has no parnasa. He's literally a fugitive, homeless fugitive. And this is the beginning of probably the darkest chapter of David's life. I wouldn't say probably. It is, unquestionably, the beginning of the darkest chapter in his life. And so certainly David Agdil, he understood the significance of this journey that he was embarking on, and he cried more. On the other hand, excellent, welcome. On the other hand, it's almost like insulting to Yonatan, to everything Yonatan did for him, to say that at the moment of departure, David cried more, David cared more. It's just it's somewhat callous to and insulting to Yonatan, who is the centerpiece of the whole story. So to do this justice, we sort of need to have a little bit more of a handle on... excuse me, have a little bit more of a handle on the relationship between Yonatan and David. That's a relationship that is truly unique. And so I wanted to devote today's class, which will both close the story of chapter 20 as well as open our discussion of chapter 21, really wanted to make the focus of today's discussion about the relationship between David and Yonatan. Why is it unique? In terms of focus of Sefer Shmuel, I would argue that there's almost more attention paid to date since we see David, since we first meet him, there's more attention paid to the relationship between David and Yonatan than almost any other dynamic in David's life. Short of perhaps Shaul, which would make sense, but certainly in terms of, I compared the amount of focus on this relationship between David and Yonatan, I would say it exceeds the focus of the relationship between David and Michal, and that Michal is his wife, in just pure column inches, how much time has been devoted from the day we met David, back in the story of Goliath. Yonatan gives him his armor. Yonatan gives him his sword. Yonatan looks after him. Yonatan defends him to the king back in 19. Yonatan defends him again in chapter 20. Yonatan comes to his aid in chapter 20. Yonatan is always there. He's going to continue. We're going to meet him again in chapter 21. This relationship between them, this bridge between them, is extraordinary and is an extraordinary focus of a sefer. Where I would have expected a story of kings are typically about the kings and their wives, the kings and their armies, the kings and their soldiers, the kings and the people. I would expect the story to be focused more on David and Shaul, David and Michal, David and why Yonatan. So Chazal making a very interesting statement. Chazal offered the following statement, which is in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, a famous lesson about David and Yonatan. Mishnah states the following: Kol ahava shehi tluya b'davar, batel davar batla ahava. V'she'ina tluya b'davar, eina b'tela li'olam. The Mishnah lays out two paradigms for relationships: a relationship that is dependent upon something. Something can be anything of some utilitarian value, and a relationship that is independent of any utilitarian value. Ahava shi tliya b'davar, and ahava she'ina tliya b'davar. The term ahava is used here as a reference to love, but as we'll see very quickly, though, it's not necessarily love in the context of a male-female relationship, but much more, but a much broader context, namely any positive relationship between two people. We described here as an ahava, that relationship can be dependent or independent. It can be ahava tluya b'davar or she'ina tluya b'davar. States the Mishnah, ezehi ahava, there's an aleph missing, ezehi ahava hatluya b'davar. What's a good example of a dependent relationship? Zu ahavat Amnon v'tamar. This is an example of Amnon v'tamar. Amnon v'tamar is a very dark story. It's about a half-sister and brother. Amnon falls in love with his half-sister, takes advantage of her, violates her, but the lust that he had for her before their act together is transferred into a deep-seated hatred after the sin. In other words, that's clearly an ahava which is dependent upon a particular utilitarian function. It's not even an ahava, it's a lust. But it's a relationship that has a particular dependence. Remove that factor, and suddenly that relationship falls apart, if there's a relationship to talk about. That's sort of the other end of the spectrum, the dark, negative end of the spectrum. On the flip side, v'she'inat li'a b'davar, what is a paradigmatic example of a relationship that is independent, that is pure, that is not based on any particular utilitarian function or value? Zu ahavat David v'Yonatan. An example that's cited is the example of David and Yonatan as the paradigmatic example of a relationship, not a male-female relationship, just a relationship, that friendship that is totally pure, not based on any particular utilitarian goal. Yonatan's friendship with David isn't because he wants to use David to become the king, or David's relationship with him isn't because he wants to use him to get close to the Michal, or in any other function, but rather just shared value, relationship, interest, a sense of camaraderie, partnership that starts after the Battle of Goliath. It starts with a sense of faith that Yonatan has in battle, in the Battle of Michmas, and that David has in battle, in the Battle of Goliath. They share a certain vision of God's role in their lives, and it brings them close together to the point where David, where Yonatan realizes very right away that David is the one suited to be king. Yonatan is destined to be his partner. He makes a brit with him. This is a pristine and pure relationship, and the Navi spends an extraordinary amount of time developing this relationship. more than even the relationships between David and the, let's call it in a generic term, the women in David's life. Which is also an interesting factor. Right? There, next to Yonatan, the only other individual who has as much focus in the relationship with David is Shaul, but that's of course a negative relationship, not a positive one. But David has other people in his lives. He has Michal. One half a chapter in the story of Michal. Not a lot of stories. Certainly much more attention paid to Yonatan. Another example. Jump to, we're going to do a little jumping around today. Jump to the beginning of Shmuel Bet. Beginning of Shmuel Bet is the David finds out about the death of Shaul and his sons, including Yonatan, on Har Gilboa in the war with the Plishtim, and he eulogizes them together. A very famous eulogy. It's often read publicly at various events like Yom HaZikaron commemorations. A very famous passage. I want to take a look at it, particularly with a focus on one aspect of it. Here he is eulogizing the fall of the king of Israel, of Shaul. Perek Aleph, Shmuel Bet, Perek Aleph, starting with Pasuk Yud Zayin. We're going to skip and jump, but we'll start with Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayikonen David et hakinazot. Everybody have it? Vayikonen David et hakinazot al Shaul ve'al Yonatan beno. This is a eulogy he offers for Shaul, king of Israel, and Yonatan. The fact that Yonatan features so prominently in his eulogy for Shaul is not an accident. Because to David, there's the national tragedy, which is the death of Shaul, and there's the personal tragedy, which is the death of Yonatan. Starting with Pasuk Yitet, Hatzvi Yisrael, the desired one of Israel, Al Bamotecha Chalal, who fell on the high place, Ech Naflu Gibori, how the mighty ones have fallen. Al Tagide Begat, Al Tavasu Bechutzot Ashkelon, Pen Tismachna Benot Plishtim, Pen Talozna Benot Arelim, don't tell the Plishtim, don't tell the enemies, they shouldn't rejoice over the fall of the heroes of Israel. Harei Begoboa Al Tal Ve'al Matal Alechem Uste Tumot, mountains of Gilboa should not have rain, they should, because the choice ones of the shield of Israel, Magen Shaul, has fallen, and the king has fallen. Pasuk of Bet, Midam Chalalim Mechelev Giborim, Keshet Yonatan Lo Nasag Achor VeChelev Shaul Lo Tashuv Rekam. The bow of Yonatan shall not return, shall not turn back. The sword of Shaul shall not return empty. Shaul v'Yonatan ne'avim b'ne'imim b'chayehem uv'motam lo nifradu. Shaul and Yonatan, loved and sweet in their lives, in their death shall not be parted from each other. Minisharim kalu me'arayot gaveru, stronger than lions, quicker than, lighter than eagles. B'not Yisrael el Shaul b'chena, daughters of Israel, cry over Shaul, king of Israel, who was killed. Hamal bishchem shani im adanim, hamale adi zahav al levushchem. Ech naflu giborim, how mighty ones have fallen, betoch ha-mechama, Yonatan al bamotecha chalal. Yonatan, who has fallen in the high places. So up until this point, his focus has been on combination of Shaul and Yonatan. And then in Pasuk of Hey, he shifts. B'toch Yonatan ha-bamotecha chalal, tsar li alecha, achi Yonatan, na'amta li ma'od. My angst, my anguish for you, Yonatan, who has so sweet to me. his final word in this eulogy is reserved for Yonatan. Nifla'atan avatcha li me'ahavat nashim. More wondrous to me has been your love than even the love of women. And that statement is what I want to focus on at the beginning tonight. Ech naflu giborim b'yavdu klei mechama. It's an astounding comment. Nifla'ata. Excuse me?
How well does that go over with Michal?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Michal is a very complex part of the story. His comment here has generated a great deal of discussion, some of it very inappropriate. I'm sure you've heard the various accusations thrown at David and Yonatan into their relationship. Bear in mind, and I'll offer one comment on that piece of that. You're familiar with what I'm talking about, no?
I know nothing.
Oh, the critics who believe that David and Yonatan had a sexual relationship. Okay. I think it's absolute heresy. Not only is it heresy,
biblical critics.
I think it's absolute. Not only is it absolute heresy, I think it's a total perversion of the text and
the sensitivity of it.
Understand the language of Tanakh. Not only of Tanakh, I would say even up until almost probably 100, 150 years ago, in all literature. It was not uncommon to use expressions that would have been reserved for, in today's world, for an intimate relationship to describe relationships between any individuals that are close, including, what's the term I'm looking for? There's a word I'm looking for. English is slipping.
Platonic?
That's the word. Right? Even platonic relationships. Meaning, two individuals, male or female, doesn't matter. The language that would be used to describe would not be uncommon for them to talk in a manner that was reflected an intimacy and a closeness that in today's context would be reserved solely for sexual relationships, but in those contexts, the issue of sexuality was not part of the conversation. What was part of the conversation was an intimacy and a closeness that was based on a true connection between individuals. And so for David to talk about Yonatan as a reflection of an individual for whom his relationship was more productive, more sweet, more important, more loved, more intense, even then his relationships with the women in his life, is not a perversion of the truth. It's in fact very accurate. Bear in mind that, for the most part, right now, at this point, the beginning of Sefer Shmuel Bet, he's just coming to the throne. He's been on the run all these years in a war with Shaul. The primary woman to whom he has had any relationship has been Michal. And he left her back in chapter, she left him, where she sent him on his journey back in chapter 19. And then Shaul gave her to another husband. Because Shaul just wanted to. Right? David's out of his life, so he gives it to Palti ben Laish. And eventually she'll come back to David, but that's a story that takes place later. Okay? So Michal is a very complex part of his story. Whereas Yonatan is not only not complex, but Yonatan is there for him at critical junctures of the story. Go one step further. He has a dynamic with other women in his story. There are other women that feature in the story of David's life up until this point, but not necessarily in a positive way. There are other women who are expressed as having a wonder and an awe for David. To whom am I referring?
I don't know. Look.
They typically sing, these women.
Oh.
And the only other women of whom we have a reference in the story of David up until this point, besides Michal, has been the choir.
Right.
Remember the choir? The women who sang when David returned from battle. Right. And they sang a very, should I put it, a meaningful but also a very dangerous song that's essentially created the rift between Shaul and David in the first place. Which turn to Perek, back to Shmuel Aleph, go to Perek Yilchet, Pasuk Vav. When David returned from his battle with the Plishtim, all the women came out to sing to greet David. The women sang and responded and proclaimed, Shaul by the thousands, David by the tens of thousands. That song was the source of the initial rift and jealousy between Shaul and David. So famous is that song, so famous, so central, that if we go forward into Parakhov Aleph, so where we are in the story, David is about to depart from his meeting with Yonatan. He's going to go on this journey that's going to lead him to two places. The first is Nov, which is where the Mishkan is. He's going to meet with the Kohen Gadol. And from Nov, he's going to run, recognizing that he is nowhere safe to run to in the land of Israel under the jurisdiction of Shaul. He's going to have to run to outside of the jurisdiction of Shaul, which is Eretz Plishtim or Eretz Moab or anywhere outside of that jurisdiction. So the first place he's going to run to is Eretz Plishtim. And so he goes running right into the hands of Achish, king of Gat, primary city of the Plishtim, which is in Perichav Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayakom David vayivrach bayom ahum ipnei Shaul vayavo el Achish melech Gat. Runs from Shaul. You see where I am? Perichav Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Runs from Shaul, Vayivrach b'yom ahu, Vayavo el Achish, comes to Achish, king of Gat. Vayamru avde Achish elav, the servants of Achish say to him, Halo ze David melech haaretz, this is David, king of the land. Why they call him king of the land is part of a conversation we'll have when we come to this story in depth, but they certainly perceive David as being the representative of the king, or the leader, or the true leader, or however they. It's not a phrase that Shaul would have been happy with. Halo ze ya'anu b'mocholot lemor, hika Shaul ba'alafav v'David b'rivivotav. This is the one about whom the women are singing, hika Shaul ba'alafav v'David b'rivivotav. Shaul smote with thousands and David tens of thousands. So the Plishtim are quoting the song. Okay? Top of the billboard. The Plishtim are getting on the radio. The Plishtim are singing the song. So when you think of David's world at the beginning of Shmuel Bet, David's world has been essentially driven apart by this echo of the women who are singing his praises over that of Shaul, created a rift between him and a Shaul, marries Michal. Michal, in the first moment that Shaul threatens David's life, Michal throws him out the window, ostensibly to save his life, but essentially she lets him out the window and he goes. And those are the women in David's story. What's the flip side? The flip side is the one individual in the story who has, from the word go, done everything in his power to bridge the world of Shaul and David. Who's the one? If the women are driving a wedge between Shaul and David, who's the one individual who's been trying desperately to bridge the two? It's Yonatan. We've seen that over and over again. Perek Yotet, Perek Chav, Perek Chav Gimel, he'll come to him again and he'll say to him, you, David, are going to be king, and I will be your Mishneh, I will be your assistant, I will be your second, because he understood Yonatan, crown prince, heir to the throne, is only too happy to abdicate that throne to David, because he knows that David is destined to be the king. And he's willing, and he goes out of his way to try to appease Shaul, and try to calm Shaul, in order to allow for David the peaceful transition into that role. That's Yonatan's mandate. That's his mission purpose. So no surprise, therefore, to find that critical moment when David is reflecting on Yonatan's life and his declaration that Niflata avatcha mi'avat nashim, your relationship with me, your effort, your connection, your brit with me has been the most productive and important part of my life till this point, more so than even certainly the women in the choir, but even if I would argue, even with Michal.
Why would David be eulogizing Shaul and saying such good things about Shaul?
So the answer to that question we'll have to wait until we read through the next 9 chapters, meaning, or learn through them, meaning David never held a grudge against Shaul. It was a very unidirectional grudge. It was Shaul chasing David. David twice has the opportunity to save, to kill Shaul, refuses to do it, talks about Shaul as the Mashiach Hashem, the anointed one of God. David held Shaul in the highest esteem, even till the end of his... He was the king of Israel, Shaul. So for David, this is a eulogy for the king of Israel. He's moving into that role now, but he certainly didn't want to take any steps to push that, to push Shaul in that direction. So it's part of the irony of the relationship. So all of this was
Is that a respect for the position, or is that a respect for Shaul? Because almost nothing in the relationship other than Shaul looking to David for comfort for when he was starting to lose it and have him play the harp. But otherwise, what did David observe about Shaul that was so
I don't know the answer. I don't know if the answer to that question is at the very minimal, it was about the position and about the fact that he was the king of Israel. I think there was probably much more to it. And he was the king and the warrior and his father-in-law and at some point. But at the very minimum, he certainly saw him as the king of Israel, the anointed one of God, and Mashiach Hashem, and certainly had that reverence for him. But his relationship with Yonatan was on a different level, a different scale. And he ends the eulogy with a reference to Yonatan, and a very personal reflection of the reference to Yonatan, Niflata avat chali mi'avat nashim, right? That's a very personal reflection that says, this was my closest confidant that I had in my life. Mm-hmm. No one stood by David's side more than Yonatan up until the point where they part company. And it's that one... that crack, that one moment when David and Yonatan part company, when Yonatan says to David, you need to run, and you need to run now, and you feel that connection between them, they cry over each other's shoulders, they kissed each other, they hugged each other, they embraced each other, ad Davidik dil. But David felt it more. And in this context, I understand why David felt it more. He was being forced to run alone, where Yonatan has always been at his side. Now, he's on his own, and he truly is on his own. And that's the most painful part of this episode, that he really feels that loneliness, that sense of... I wouldn't call it yet abandonment, because I don't think Yonatan abandons him, but certainly the disappointment and the tragedy of him now having to go out on his own without the very individual who has been so much a part of his safe haven, if you will, his voice back into the kingdom. He runs when he encounters Shaul at by Shmuel in Ramat Nayot. Who does he run back to? Yonatan. When Yonatan tries to come, try to defend him, and he risks his life before Shaul, Yonatan's there to come out and tell him with the arrows what's going on. And now, David is on his own. So if we understand the depth of their relationship and how much of a role Yonatan plays in David's life, then we have a better understanding of why it says that David exceeded in crying. The Ad Davidic deal. There is a loneliness that he's now going to have to face. That by being sort of left out of his closest friend. There's an additional explanation or additional piece to it, which I'm going to come back to.
At that moment in time, does David then recognize that Yonatan's made a decision to? I haven't read the rest of the story, so I don't.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's exactly the point in which Yonatan says to him, "You have to run. We're going to keep a brit between us," meaning that God. May God be with you. So, but that's it. He's running.
But is Yonatan siding with his father?
Yes.
Or is he...
Yes, siding with his father. He's not going with them.
To protect David because he's the right-hand guy to...
I think David, based on everything we've said over the last couple of classes, I think David had expected a different outcome.
Yonatan would come with him.
Yeah. And that's, I think, also reflected in that moment of disappointment. Chazal put it in different terms, but before I put it into the language of Chazal, in Midrashei Chazal, we have to go into the next chapter for a moment. But I think that this is the issue, is that David is feeling that sense that Yonatan is sending him off rather than coming together, preparing the horses and running. And that's a bit.
What's flip it. So now what's Yonatan thinking? He's going to go off with
Shaul. Yonatan, I wouldn't want to be in Yonatan's place for anything in the world. Yonatan is facing a very difficult choice. He has a choice between going with David as a fugitive. I need to close this wall. If you don't mind, just close the wall. He's facing the choice of going with David with David as a fugitive, or returning to Shaul. You right with that? The other piece of it requires us to know a little bit of what goes on next. So for that, we're going to jump into the next part of the story, and then we'll come back to the last piece. Pasuk Membet, Vayomer Yonatan le David, lech l'shalom. Yonatan says to David, go in peace. Asher nishbanu shneinu anachnu b'shem Hashem lemor, l'Hashem yeh b'ni uv'necho, ben zari uv'en zarecha ad olam. Go in peace. God will be with us, between us. We have an eternal pact between us. Always. Pasuk Chavalev, sorry, Perek Chavalev, Pasuk Aleph, Vayakum, Vayelach, V'Yonatan, Bahayir. Everybody see where I am? Mm-hmm. Beginning Perek Chavalev. He got up, he left, and Yonatan returned to the city. Mm-hmm. Who got up and who left? You sure? Vayakom vayelach, Yonatan b'ha'ir.
David.
Right? If it was Yonatan, it would have said Vayakom vayelach Yonatan,
okay.
Or Vayakom Yonatan vayelach. Vayakom vayelach et nachtov, comma, semicolon, Vayakom vayelach. He got up, he left. Yonatan b'ha'ir. Yonatan went back to the palace. Vayavod David Nova El Achimelech HaKohen, and David came to the city of Nov. Pasuk Aleph is a very interesting pasuk because the subject of the first two verbs is omitted. Vayakum vayelach, he got up and he left. Who got up and left? It's implied that it's David, but I think, Bob, you read it correctly, right? You could have said Yonatan. Moreover, who's the subject of the previous pasuk? Who's the subject of pasuk Membet, Parakhaf? Vayomer Yonatan le David, lech le shalom, shenishbanu shnenu anachnu b'shem Hashem lemor Hashem yeh beni uvenecho ven zanei uven zerecha ad olam. Who's speaking?
Yonatan.
And then vayakom vayelach. I haven't changed subjects yet. So it's a very odd terminology, very odd language. It means David, it implies David, but it doesn't say so. And you sort of get the sense that vayakom vayelach, aimlessly, David leaves, Yonatan has where to go. Yonatan, Bahair. Where is David going? Vayakom, got up, Vayelach, he left. Where did he go to? It doesn't say Vayelach David Nova. It says Vayakom, Vayelach, he got up and he left. Yonatan, Bahair. Where does he go to? We don't know. But all of that, I think, is part of the drama of the trauma, right? Meaning the moment in which David is left alone, and now he's got to figure out what to do. He has nothing, truly nothing. So where does he run to? Where does he go? Vayavo David Nove, comes to the city of Nov. So in Pasuk Bet we know where he goes. Pasuk Aleph doesn't tell us where he goes. Why?
Why didn't it say the name, though?
Say that again?
Why wouldn't Pasuk Aleph say that David was the one that got up and left?
I think it's part of that sense of aimlessness, right? It's not...
Because
there's confusion? Because he has no function, he has no focus. Where did he go to? Yonatan disappeared. Vayakum. Vayelach. Yonatan ba'ir. He's kind of this... It's part of that confusion.
So he has no game plan. Was he expecting? At what juncture did he learn that Yonatan isn't coming with
him? We are in one conversation. Yonatan embraces him. Yonatan says to him, "You need to run. You need to run now." The story of the arrows, Machachodesh. Right? Shaul is trying to kill you. You can't go back to Beit Lechem. You can't go back anywhere. You're not safe anywhere in Shaul's kingdom, in Shaul's reach. This is truly a moment which Shaul is trying to eradicate you. You need to run. Remember me. Remember our Brit between us. Yonatan returns to the city. David, Vayakom, Vayelach, got up. He left. But left to where? It doesn't tell us where he goes to until Pasuk Bet, which is in itself an odd phraseology. By Yaakov it says, "Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva vayelech Harana." Left one place to go to another. He knew where he was going. He had a journey. Vayakom vayelech, vayavo Nov. Did he happen to come to Nov? He just counted it, or he decided at that point, okay, he's going to run to Nov. But I would say it's a second tier decision. When he's first left in the field, Yonatan turns away and goes into the palace. Now David literally has to start to run.
He goes to Kohen Gadol.
And he goes to Nov. Why he goes to Nov, we'll see. That's what we're going to look at now. Vayavo David Nov. So now, what we're going to do for now is I'm going to read through the next part of the story, just so we have the facts of what's going on. I'm going to read through the next parak. And we're going to spend some time looking at this parak, but I want to read it through so we have a sense of what's going on, just the facts. Pasuk Bet. Vayavo David Nov el Achimelech HaKohen. David comes to Nov. Nov is the city, is a city of Kohanim. It's an Ir Miklat. And a city of refuge, right? Somebody commits accidental murder. It's a city in, it's today, it's, I would say almost a suburb. It's part of the northern ridge of Yerushalayim, in Eretz Binyamin. Some suggest it's around the area of Nebi Samuel, but some of you can make the suggestion that Nebi Samuel is a mispronunciation, that Nebi is really not from Nevuat Shmuel, but Nevi Shmuel, but really from the city of Nov. But it's the northern ridge of Yerushalayim. Vayavod David Nov el Achimelech HaKohen, Vayacherad Achimelech Likrat David, Vayomer lo, Madu ata levadecha, Veish enitach. Achimelech comes out to him, but with trepidation. Vayacherad. He says to him, why are you alone? Why is there nobody with you? Why is it odd for David to be alone?
He's a general.
He's a general in the army.
He's got troops to be with him.
He's a general in the army, and he is, say it louder, the king's son-in-law, which means he's part of the royal family.
Should have a bodyguard.
Right? At the very minimum, a bodyguard, certainly an entourage, possibly a whole delegation. That for the king's son-in-law to be roaming the city alone, roaming the countryside alone, is extraordinary. Now, if you knew what had just transpired between Shaul and David, it would not be that extraordinary. Which means that from the question that Achimelech poses, what can we infer?
He didn't know.
That the story's not yet public. That the events that took place in the Rosh Chodesh feast of the palace, when David didn't show up, and Shaul publicly declares him Mored B'Malchut, act of treason, abandonment from his task, abandoning his post, guilty of a criminal offense, everything that Shaul accuses him of, pre-internet, this message hasn't yet reached the countryside. Even though we're not so far, Givat Shaul is just a little bit further north than where we are. So he comes to him and he says to him, why are you alone? David, on the other hand, for his part, doesn't want Achimelech to know. Vayomer David l'Achimelech HaKohen, David says to Achimelech, HaMelech tzivani davar, Vayomer elai ish al yeda mu'uma, את הדבר אשר אנוכי שולחך ואשר ציוויתיך ואת הנערים יודעתי המקום פלוני אלמוני. I am here on the king's mission. Secret mission. So secret that nobody's allowed to know. Not even the narim who I usually go with, my bodyguards and my entourage and my soldiers and my officers. I sent them on ahead. I sent them to Makom Ploni Almoni. It's not some other place. Why? I can't even tell them. This is top secret. Nobody's allowed to.
Is there any connection here with Purim?
Purim? Yeah. Why Purim?
Doesn't it mention Ploni Almoni?
You're talking about Ruth.
Ruth,
right. Yeah. No, Ploni Almoni simply means... So the Mepharshim will talk about what... Right, we'll talk about what the word means. Ploni Almoni means any anonymous place, person, town, thing, event is Ploni Almoni. Right, right. John Doe or... Right.
And does it actually refer to a person?
No. It refers to a non-identified... It's like saying... To some place. In English we'd say to some place. Unknown. Ploni Almoni. V'yata. Okay, so this is now David still speaking to Achimelech. Ma yesh tachet yadcha? What do you have to eat? Chamisha lechem? 5 loaves of bread? Tana biyadi. Give them to me. Or animtza, or whatever else you have. V'yan ha-kohen et David v'yomer. Ein lechem chol tachet yadi. I have no non-consecrated bread in my possession. The only bread I have in my possession, kiim lechem kodesh yesh. I have holy bread, it's consecrated bread, ritual bread. Im nishmanu anari machmeisha, but I can only give it to you if the people who are going to eat it, if the lads who are with you, are not tamei, who have not been with a woman, and therefore have been able to observe their themselves in a state of purity from the tumma of Keri, which would have been if they had been with their wives. Dayan David et Kohen. So David's response to the Achimelech is, "Vayomar lo, ki mishad sura lanu kitmol shushon betzeti v'yuklei anarim kodesh v'uderachol v'afki ayom mikdash bakeli." This is one of the sentences which is unintelligible grammatically. And Mefarshim try to break it down into adding syntax where necessary to make some sense of the sentence. But more or less the sentiment is, he says, for 2 or 3 days we've been not in any contact with any women. We've been on a mission here for several days. No women have been with us. Or even if they were, certainly the last 2 or 3 days, they would not have been in any contact with us. The klei hana'arim, the utensils, the backpacks, the kelim that we're using, even they have been observed in a state of purity and sanctity, even if they're eating non-consecrated bread, uderachol, and certainly today, when they could be used for eating kodesh. Meaning, what is all of this driving at? David wants food. And the food that he's asking for is whatever Achimelech has. And the only food Achimelech has, as we'll see in a moment, is consecrated and can only be eaten in a state of purity. So David says, that's not an issue. I guarantee you, no problem. We eat everything in a state of purity. We have no tumor whatsoever.
Who is we?
He and his Na'arim, who he had sent ahead to Malcolm Plani Armoni. Remember, he's still playing.
Oh, I mean, as if there was someone. Right.
No. And he's still playing the,
sorry, I got
the role. So, Vayiten lo Kohen Kodesh. So the king gave him, the Kohen gave him these consecrated breads. Ki lo aya shem lechem. There was no other bread there. Ki im lechem hapanim. Amusarim lifnei Hashem. The only bread there was the show bread, the lechem hapanim that had been removed from the shulchan, from the presence from before God, lasum lechem chom biyomi lakho, in order to put new, fresh, warm bread on the shulchan, in the day that the bread was removed. So today, the bread off the shulchan, the lechem apanim had been removed because today the new bread had been put on, or yesterday, the hot bread, and therefore that's the only bread he had, consecrated bread. Lechem apanim.
Does he not live nearby that he could get him some food?
So that's interesting. So that these are part of the questions the Mefarshim ask. Like, why is there no other bread in this whole city? It's a whole city.
Didn't he
no.
have a lunch with him that he could share?
No lunch, no food. That's another question. Right? Why doesn't he have any food? So let's take it one step further. Let's take it one step at a time. Why does the Kohen not have any bread other than the Lechem HaPanim? You're in the Beis HaMikdash. This is where the Beis HaMikdash goes. This is where the Mishkan moves to after the Mishkan is destroyed in Shiloh. The Mizbeach comes to the city of Nov. It's going to remain here until the next chapter when Shaul will come and execute the entire city of Kohanim and the destruction of the Mishkan and his wrath for them having harbored David. One of the darkest chapters in Shaul's, the darkest moment in Shaul's life. The Mishkan is there. The Kohen's only bread that he has is the Lechem HaPanim. The Kohanim eat the Lechem HaPanim. That's what they eat. That's the, once it's removed from the Shulchan, who eats it? The Kohanim. So the Kohanim don't have any other bread because they need to consume the bread, the show bread, within one day. So they're not going to have normal baked challah for a Friday afternoon so you can have lechem mishnah. They're going to eat the lechem of the shulchan. But it's possible that there are other people in the city of Nov, it's a big city, lots of kohanim, that have food. Why aren't they part of the equation? Why is David only engaged in a conversation with Achimelech? Can he trust him?
Well, you already said that. That's a secret.
Right.
He can't tell anybody else.
I assume that he... Whether he can trust him... He's the Kohen Gadol. Whether you can trust him or not, I don't know, but he certainly can't trust anybody else. Meaning, David doesn't go into the city. He doesn't go into the city of Nov. He doesn't go in encounter with all of the Kohanim in the countryside. The less people who know he's there, the better. So he goes straight to the Mishkan. He goes straight to the Kohen Gadol. He engages with Achimelech. He pulls him aside. Achimelech comes out to greet him. Remember, Achimelech is the one who comes out to Vayecharad Likrato. Achimelech came out to him, sees him alone, doesn't understand what's going on, and he says, I'm on a secret mission. If he's on a secret mission, they're not going to go spatzir in the middle of the city. He's on a very secret mission. He can't tell anybody about it. I need bread. Do you have bread? Sure. How much? 5 loaves? No. Couple of those. Okay, give me what you have. But it's consecrated. I'll take it. Are you Tahor? Yes. Now, in the midst of everything else, there's another factor that hasn't been included, part of the conversation. Who's entitled to eat Lechem Habanim? You know the story of Lechem, but you know where this bread comes from? Let's take a quick glance. Vayikra Perek of Dalet. There are 4 major utensils in the Mishkan / Mikdash. There's the Aron in the Ark of the Covenant inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim. That is not in the Mishkan at this point. That is in Kiryat Yerim. That's been in hiding since it was taken into captivity by the Plishtim and then returned. That's still there. There's the Menorah. Opposite the Menorah is the Shulchan. And then there's the Mizbach HaKtor at the incense altar. And then outside of the Mishkan, there is the sacrificial altar. Those are the 4 major utensils of the Mishkan, operative vessels of the Mishkan / Mikdash. So this Shulchan that sat inside the sanctuary, what was it used for? So if you look at Vayikra Perek Chav Daled, it says, starting with Pasuk Hey. Malakachta solet, ve'afita ota 12 chalot, 12 yeah chalah ha'achat. Take flour and bake from this flour 12 loaves of bread. Each loaf of bread has to be made up of 2 esronim of flour. That's an enormous amount of flour. That is a very large challah. This past summer, we had the opportunity to go to there's a guy in the I think he's in the Tel Aviv, in the Manana area, who has a bakery in his house. I forgot his name, but he ran a workshop called the breads of the Beit HaMikdash, in which he goes through the recipes and they bake the various kinds of breads that they use in the Beit HaMikdash. He has made the molds for the baking of these showbreads. He has the mold to scale, the actual size of these loaves. There's 2 opinions in the Gemara as to whether they were made in sort of a round shape or like a half a square. I don't know if you've seen the pictures. Because the two loaves, the loaf of bread that's of this size has to fit into a small space. So in order to do that, you need to shape it in a certain way. He has these molds, he makes them both ways. We actually baked them, and I might even have a picture. I'm not sure how quickly I can pull it up. But I might even have a picture. Mm-hmm. There we go. Loaves of the Beit HaMikdash. Breads of the Beit HaMikdash. This is the advertisement for this event. Breads of the Beit HaMikdash. There we made, that was like mincha type of meal offer, type of bread, flatbreads. And then he made, and there are your showbreads.
Wow.
Okay, that's the round one. Those are the round ones.
There's thickness to them?
Yes.
Yeah.
And those are the square ones.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay. And the mold that he used to make them with is, and you can see how big they are. These are the round molds that he uses to bake them in that shape. Can you see?
Hmm.
Wow.
And these are the square ones.
Very cool.
And he has a big bake oven and he bakes them. So they're quite large. You get a sense of them. They're quite large.
The Temple Institute agree with his morals?
I think so. I think they're legit. Be that as it may, back to our story. V'samta otam shtayim ma'arachot sheish ha'ma'arachet al shulchan ha'tahor lifnei Hashem. You place them on these two sets of six each, right? Two sets of breads, one on top of the other, two times six, because there are 12 of them, on the table, tahor, pure, can't be tamei, before God, meaning in the Mishkan. V'natatala ma'arachet levanazaka, and the two containers with sort of incense or that was burnt. Vayta lalechem lazgali she'ashem. That's sort of the offering for the bread. This incense that was burnt, this levona, frankincense. B'yom haShabbat, b'yom haShabbat, yarchenu lifnei Hashem tamid. What day were they placed on the table?
Shabbat.
Me'et bnei Yisrael brit olam. And who ate them? Vayta la'aron ulevanav. Aaron and his children, meaning Kohanim. And they can only be eaten in a holy place, meaning in the Mishkan or in the Mikdash. Ki kodesh kodeshim ulomei, she'a Hashem echok olam. They were considered kodesh kodeshim, holy of holies. Can only be eaten by Kohanim, only in the Mishkan, only for that day. And when Shabbat, and every Shabbat they were placed anew. So in addition to everything else, there's two additional factors that come out of the story based on the Pesukim in Vayikra. Number one, who's entitled to eat them?
Kohanim.
Only Kohanim. So why could David eat them? David's not a Kohen.
Yehuda.
And Shevet Yudei is certainly not a Kohen. So the conversation between David and Achimelech is about whether they're Tahor. At no point does the conversation go to, wait a second, you can't eat these showbreads, you're not a Kohen. Problem number one. Problem number two, what day of the week are these breads placed on the Mishkan? Shabbat. Which means what day of the week did David arrive in Nov, Eve, Irakonim? On Shabbat? Odd?
Mm-hmm.
And it clearly states that they were placed that day. Lasum lechem chom b'yomi lakho. So he arrives on Shabbos. He's asking to eat lechem. He knows that they're kodesh. He knows that they're shobet. He knows the lechem upon him. And yet he asks to eat them. And yet Achimelech gives it to him. Why? There's only one possible explanation.
It's a miracle.
No. There's only one possible explanation that could justify David traveling on Shabbat, eating the shobet of the Beit HaMikdash, and convince Achimelech that he needs to do this. Correct, because he's in danger. Well, what's the sakana? What's the sakana? That Shaul's on his trail?
No,
Shaul's
APB.
But the secret mission was a front. The secret mission is not true.
Well, but he is running.
But why does David justify eating the lechem upon him? Why does David justify arriving on Shabbat?
If it's a military mission, it's okay.
Yeah, but he's not on the military mission, is he?
He's running for his life.
He's running for his life.
Why does he need to eat the lechem upon him? Go to wait till tomorrow and you'll have normal bread.
He could die. He's so hungry.
Right. Because David is dying of hunger. David arrives in Nov Irakonim dying, literally dying of hunger. Okay. This man has not only been on the run, he's not only been a fugitive, he hasn't eaten in days, not hours, days. And the first thing he arrives, literally, look at the conversation. He arrives in Nov, and the first thing he says to the Melech, to the Kohen, the first thing he says to Achimelech Makohen is, "Do you have any bread? Do you have any food?" That does not sound like a man. Does that not sound like a man who is desperate of hunger? How odd is it, Achimelech? You're on a secret mission. Your men, you sent off to plenty of money. And the first thing you ask me about is food. Achimelech puts the two and two together, I would think, fairly quickly. But from David's perspective, Chazal describes this. Chazal talk about the fact that he, Chazal Bulmus, that he was overwhelmed by Bulmus. Bulmus is translated typically as bulimia. But essentially saying that he was dying of hunger, and that he was in a moment where, as an act of desperation, he needed food. And so he allows himself to eat of the lechem apanim, even though it's a violation of the law of the Torah, but it's pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh, nochem kol ha-mitzvot shebat Torah. For pikuach nefesh, you can eat the lechem apanim. So it's a remarkable moment. He arrives in Shabbos, pikuach nefesh. He allows himself to eat of the lechem apanim, pikuach nefesh.
I had a different take.
Which is?
Which is, who's the last Kohen Gadol that we knew about? You had Eli, and you had...
He's a grandson of Eli.
Right, so we're coming from, right, we had Hophni and Pinchas, we had a corrupt situation going
on. Oh, we'll come back to that issue.
So did he really care?
I will come back to that, because I think he does care, but you may be right. From Achimelech's perspective, there may be an additional factor there. But let's leave it for now, because we will come back to that piece of the story and the role of Eli's lineage and legacy in this story. You're 100% correct. But certainly from David's perspective, that's not the issue. From David's perspective, David allows himself to run to Nov, to ask for the lechem upon him, and to travel on Shabbat, because David sees it as a matter of pikuach nefesh. What Achimelech was dealing with, we'll deal with. We'll talk about. But from David's perspective, it was certainly a matter of pikuach nefesh. So I have a simple question. Why is he so hungry?
You just said he was escaping for a couple of days, and
we don't know the time.
Kivat Sha'ul, north of Yerushalayim, Eretz Binyamin. Nov, Eretz Binyamin. We don't know the time frame.
We don't know when he left Michal. When Michal kicked him out of the house.
Well, that's already in the previous story. When the last thing that happened was the engagement with Yonatan.
Right. But did Yonatan give him food?
That's the question. I'll go one step further.
You're saying that Yonatan purposely handicapped him?
No, I don't think he did it on purpose. But look at source 4 for a moment. This is a remarkable comment of Chazal. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and if it wasn't in the Talmud, if the Gemara didn't say it, I it would be astounding for us to say such a thing. Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, Ilmalei ilvau Yonatan leDavid shtei kikarot lechem. Lo nehrga nov irakonim v'lo nitrag do'ega adami v'lo nehrag sh'ul v'shloshet banav. Had Yonatan given David 2 loaves of bread, the entire tragedy of the death of the city of Konim and the fall of the Bet Mikdash of the Mishkan could have been averted. Who do they place the blame on? Yonatan. It's really astounding. Now, I'll share with you an explanation of this Gemara in a moment. But I want to come back to that moment. Right? Chazal are pointing to a reason why David arrives in Nov desperate, hungry, dying of hunger. They point to a critical moment in the story, which is the moment of the departure between David and Shaul. David and Yonatan. Why at that moment of departure is David dying of hunger?
Maybe because he expected a different outcome, and for Yonatan to at least join him or give him food or help him.
Expected a different outcome, expected Yonatan to join him. When he went into hiding, why didn't he take food with him? Remember, he's hiding in the field. He's hiding in the field when Yonatan goes after the Sudat HaMelech.
Right.
Correct? And it says that day, or the day Shaul missed him, the next day he challenges Yonatan where he is, when he has this conflict with Yonatan in the end, Yonatan doesn't eat that day. Yonatan doesn't eat that day. David hasn't eaten in 2 days. Why? Because he went into hiding Erev Rosh Chodesh. But one day Rosh Chodesh became 2 days Rosh Chodesh.
What can you eat on...
David's hiding. He went into hiding for 1 day. So for 1 day, he didn't take provisions with him. But that 1 day turned into 2. That's the answer to the question that I asked a couple of weeks ago, is why is it significant that we went from 1 day Rosh Chodesh to 2 days Rosh Chodesh? He went into hiding with no provisions because he was expecting it to be a 24-hour ordeal. turns out to be a 48-hour ordeal. And then he and Yonatan finally meet, and Yonatan says, you need to run. When? Now. Don't stop for lunch. You can't stop for lunch. You need to run for your life. This is desperate. You're pikuach nefesh. You have no idea what Shaul is capable of doing right now. So he runs. And it takes him a day or two to reach Nevo Kohanim. He hasn't eaten in a week. But it all starts from the fact that he went into hiding, expecting it to be a short period of time. It turned out to be much longer than he had expected. So he didn't take any provisions. And when Yonatan and he finally get together in that one critical moment of breath between the visit, when the Na'ar is running out to get the arrows, Yonatan doesn't have the time or the luxury to bring him food. And David goes running on his journey without food. Ends up in Novi Arkonim and eats the lechem upon him. When Shaul hears that Achimelech gave David the lechem upon him, he executes the entire city. That's the sequence of events. So I come back to the question, what does Chazal really mean? When they say that had Yonatan given David food, the entire tragedy could have been averted. They really worried. Was that really the focus here? Was that Yonatan should have brought him a snack to eat on the road? Or is it a reflection of a much broader issue, which is that Yonatan didn't need to bring David food if Yonatan would have not had needed to bring David food if Yonatan had chosen differently. Yonatan had chosen to go with David, then the whole story would have been different. He would have had the sponsor of the prince. He would have been the conflict with Shaul would have ended in a day or two or a week. You can't call him a fugitive when the crown prince is on his side. It's a feud within the royal family. He would have had the legitimization of his position. He would have been legitimate in the eyes of the people. He would have had the support of Yonatan. The whole story would have been different. That's what David was hoping for. And I think Chazal sensed that as well. And so they place the story, the tragedy of the destruction of Nov, to an extent, they place it on the shoulders of the one who sent him on his way without food, which is another way of saying on the shoulders of the one who sent him on his way rather than going with him. That's where I think in this medrash lies the heart of the angst that Chazal felt in Yonatan's decision to stand by Shaul rather than to stand by David. After everything Yonatan represented to David, that was a moment that hurt. And that's Ad Davidic deal. That's what David cried.
Does Yonatan know that Shmuel Hanavi had removed not kingship, but I don't know.
He certainly knows that David is destined to be the king. He says it explicitly in Parakov Gimel. I don't think it's relevant. Meaning he may or may not know about it. We don't know. But he certainly does.
Had he known about it, he knew that Shaul's days were numbered.
He knows that anyway. He knows that we see that in Parakov Gimel. He knows that David is going to be king. He says it. Not only does he say it, he says that his father knows it. You are going to be the king and I will be your Mishneh, and my father also knows this. The conversation they have in Parakov Gimel. And interestingly, there are moments of contact between Shaul and Yonatan throughout the story. That's one of them, a chapter later, right? There are moments when they get back together, when they see each other, when there's a connection between them. Shaul accuses Yonatan of being in cahoots with and in connection with David throughout this period of time. Yonatan has connections with David, interactions with him throughout this period of his hiding as a fugitive. But he always returns to his father. His decision was a decision that he would, that his fate would lie with his father's, and literally they die together on the battlefield. And that's, I think, the key of the tragedy. That I would argue that that's probably the most tragic decision in all of Sefer Shmuel. for Yonatan's moment when he chooses to go back to his father and not to go with David changes the entire trajectory of Sefer Shemuel. Okay, we will adjourn here. Mizrat Hashem, next week we will pick up the rest of the story of Parak Aleph and analyze it in more detail.